matter what people say, we got it going on. Who cares about what they think?
You know me, I'm the hottest in the street.
WJMS. This is According to RP.
Turn up the volume, kick back, and get raw with us.
From the latest hip hop beats, to social issues that cripple the black community, all from the perspective of a young, strong black woman.
A strong black woman.
Welcome back, everyone, for another episode of According to RP on WJMS Radio. It's your girl, Rita Pierre, your host. And as always, I'm hoping that you are starting off your week or you're getting ready to start your week on a good foot. It's a little... So I'm so used to saying that I hope you guys are having a wonderful week so far, because my show would end on, you know, would, I guess, air on a Thursday. And so by that time, you guys were already well into the work week. But now that the show is on a Sunday, I am now, I'm here, you're hearing my voice to start off your week. So I'm wishing you guys the best of luck in preparations for the start of the new week. But last week was July 4th, so it was a slow week for a lot of people, and even the beginning of, I mean, people are still kind of on vacation mode. I know a lot of people are just going to be coming back to work either Monday or Tuesday of this week, but I hope everyone had a great July 4th. You know, it's interesting because now that we're in a spirit of wokeness in our community, I'm seeing more and more posts. Well, this particular July 4th, I saw so many posts about, this is not my Independence Day. My holiday is Juneteenth. We don't celebrate Independence Day. All this extra stuff. And I'm always here for the wokeness. I'm always here for this era of enlightenment that it looks like people are going through. I hope it's a realistic one and not a fake one. But to be very honest, for me, July 4th was never about independence. I grew up Haitian, and 4th of July is not a Haitian holiday. So for me, I never grew up really in the whole spirit of red, white, and blue and American independence. July 4th for me was a holiday because it was a time that I was not in school. It was a time that I was not at summer school or summer camp or wherever the hell, you know, I was placed around the July 4th holiday. And it signified a period of family time. It was almost like the summer version of Thanksgiving for a lot of Haitian kids, because we get together, we, you know, we eat Haitian food as well as eating, you know, I guess traditional barbecue food like the hamburgers, the hot dogs and whatnot. So July 4th was never really a celebration about the 4th. It was just another day that we had off to run around and eat food. So, you know, it was, I don't know. So as I see these posts that are like, oh, not my holiday, hashtag Juneteenth is my holiday, all this other stuff, I'm like, I'm here for it. I'm here for the wokeness, you know. But I know with social media, as like everything else that I guess trends on social media, you know, it's one of those things, like, it's cool to do. You want to be part of that bandwagon. Let's see next year, the next couple of years, if people are still hashtagging not my holiday. But so I had a great holiday because I was with my family. I was with my family. I was with my friends. It was a really great, like, holiday period. I was at Long Beach with my son and my cousin. Shout out to George, Cynthia, and Orville, and the rest of, you know, Poppy was there, Cynthia and George's father. It was his birthday. Shout out to him and his birthday. And then, like, what, yesterday? Yeah, yesterday, Saturday, I came to Maryland. I am one of those friends, guys. I am a ride or die friend. I am a very supportive friend. My homegirl, my law school sister, she was throwing a barbecue in Maryland. So I left yesterday morning, got on my bus. Well, it ended up being the train, but that's a whole fiasco for another day. Either way, after hours of trying to figure out transportation, I actually made it to Maryland, spent a wonderful time with her and her family. My other friend Lyo had come through from Jersey. Again, like, when you have real friends, like, you know, because Lyo came from New Jersey just to come celebrate and just hang out and really just spend time. And then my best friend lives in Maryland, his fiance lives in Maryland. So then I met up with them and we had a great night as well. So I'm really coming off of a family and friend high, I guess, these last couple of days. And again, I feel like that's what July 4th does for at least you know, my friends and I, it's a time for us to be, you know, to get together and to just really fellowship. So one thing I will say, this is something that just popped into my head as I was thinking about food and July 4th. So I don't like to put labels on myself because I'm just not one of those people. But I have not had meat. Those of you who've heard the story many times, I have not had meat since February. So I had done a Daniel's fast this past February. It was supposed to be 21 days. It ended up being 30 days. And I mean, I reaped so many benefits from this, and I definitely guarantee. I definitely what's the word? Why am I going through a mental? I encourage and I support anybody. I'm encouraging everybody or anybody to go through and actually do a Daniel's fast. It doesn't have to be for spiritual reasons. It could be for just a cleanse, but it definitely did wonders for my mind, my soul, my body. I had lost like 15 pounds and I just felt so light. I felt, you know, so alert. It was good for me at least. And so, one of the things, I guess, that resulted of this Daniel's fast is that I just never went back to meat. I had fully intended to go back to eating chicken like maybe a week or two later. And it's been since February and I have not had any meat. I wasn't even eating fish until maybe about a month ago. So, I don't know. It's one of those things, I guess, when you do things for like too long, like after 30 days, it becomes like you, I don't know, it's a habit or you break a habit, whatever that thing goes. So I haven't had meat. I've seen it. I have not been enticed to eat it. Long story short, I say all that to say this. July 4th, there was hamburgers, hot dogs all over the damn place in my face. And I was like, damn, when we initially did the barbecue in Long Island, I was like, what am I going to eat? Because I'm not going to start eating beef burgers and turkey burgers and hot dogs now. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, how am I celebrating July 4th? But my cousins got me some salmon burgers. And salmon burgers are one of the best burgers, in my opinion. Like, they're amazing if you get a good brand. And so I did that. And then when I went to Maryland, my homegirl went and bought salmon. She made sure that there was, like, veggie skewers. There was jollof rice. Like, you know, so, where was I going with all this? Yes, I have a pet peeve when it comes to that, though. For those of you who are like not vegetarian, not pescatarian, for those of you who are eating meat like willingly, gladly, and all this extra stuff, stop eating the food that's reserved for the vegetarians, vegans, and pescatarians. I'm like, I mean, this didn't really happen to me, but I saw it with my own eyes with other people. We're at an event. They're saying, listen, you know, we have friends who are vegans, vegetarians, whatever. The meat eaters are eating their meat and then they're all up in the salmon and then they're all up in like the vegan vegetarian dishes. Why are you eating a veggie burger and you have a hamburger, a real meat burger on your plate? Meanwhile, those of us who are not eating meat, whether by choice or because of health reasons or whatever the case is, you can't share with us. So therefore, if you can't share with us, we shouldn't have to share with you. Because at the end of the day, when all of the vegetarian and pescatarian options are gone, you still have all your meat and we're looking at you. And all we could likely have at that point is the bun and maybe lettuce, if there is any such, you know, furnishings or was it? I don't know. Is it furnishings? Any such extras that go on your sandwich. So this is just a word to the wise. If you want to keep the friends that you have, if you want to make a good impression, if you don't want to be the talk of the vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian community, if you're at an event, particularly events like Thanksgiving, July 4th, where there's an abundance of meat around, do us all a favor who are not eating meat at the time. Leave our vegetarian foods, our salmons, our pescatarian foods, our vegan foods alone. Thank you, management. So, the other thing I wanted to talk about is that this week I started my new job this week. So, I had a great week in that respect as well, too. So I started my new job during the week of July 4th, which was also amazing because people were away. You know, it gave me like an extra time to kind of slowly adjust because I did not take a break between my former job and my new job. But I started a new job this week. I don't know if I mentioned this at all in any of my other shows. Probably not. But so far, I love it. I love the opportunity. I love the growth potential. I love the people I work with so far. I love where I see this going. Let's, you know, knocking on wood, crossing fingers, crossing toes that, you know, I can report that I still love it in a month. But that was a big highlight for me this week. And so that was that. I'm sure as future shows go on, I'll reference this new job. But I wanted to just mention that, you know, God is working in my life. God is good. And things are, you know, really starting to come into place. And, you know, even with that being said, like, you know, words of encouragement for all of you out there who are going through a season of like struggle, going through a season of like, I don't know what the hell's going on with my life. You're kind of lost. It's hard to keep things in perspective. Listen, I'm human. You're human. That's what we do. Especially those of you who like kind of follow like my way of thinking. Like I'm a very logical individual. I'm a very realistic individual. So, you know, faith sometimes is a little hard and challenging because you're so like technical, logical, and, you know, realistic. But I will just say this. Hold on. Sometimes you really just don't know. I mean, it's hard to really like put things in perspective, and you don't really know how to manage and balance, you know, your emotions, your thoughts around certain things. And, you know, being hopeful is, again, not the easiest thing to be, especially when you're seeing things not really fitting. But what I had been doing and what I will continue to be doing is just writing things down, like whether it be in a prayer journal, whether it be on a post-it somewhere, and like just put things out there in existence and then, you know, just fall back a little bit. I'm like the worst person to speak because I'm like, it's the worst. I mean, I just can't fall back. Sometimes I'm just like, oh, I think I'm falling back, and I'm like still trying to like hustle and put things together. But I knew for a long time that I wanted a change in terms of a career. I wanted a new job. I wanted something that was going to just put me at a new level. But, you know, we're tired. We're all tired people. Who has time to be applying for jobs all the time? And so this particular job kind of, you know, came out of nowhere almost. Like, I did not expect this. If you were to ask me 6 months ago, if you were to ask me 3 months ago, you know, would I be starting a new job in a different industry? I would look at you like, no. You know, I would have felt like I was stuck, and I would have just said, ah, maybe 2020. You know, like every year you're pushing it off to the new year. Maybe 2020, maybe 2021. I didn't really see a breakthrough in sight, you know? I felt like something had to shift, but I just didn't know when, I didn't know how. But long story short, remaining as faithful as you can, and just knowing that at the end of the day, you do the best that you can, but you kind of leave it, you know, to God, leave it to the universe, whatever it is that you're believing in, and that knowing that things, you know, especially when you know that they have to change, that at some point they will, but it's all about timing. You know, our time is not God's time. A lot of time we feel like things need to happen right now, and they don't have to happen right now, because if they happened at the moment that we wanted it to happen, we would be shit out of luck. But, you know, I truly appreciate the lessons I learned through the last couple of months of, you know, struggling and trying to figure out my life. Cause now I feel like there definitely is a rainbow at the end of the tunnel. Is that how it goes? No, a rainbow at the end of the tunnel. I believe that's how you say it. And that, you know, things are going to look up. They could only go up from here. So that's that highlight. So we are going to go through our preliminary, so you know what time it is. It is now time for our Urban Dictionary Word of the Week.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
May I have the definition?
What does skeet skeet mean?
What's on fleek?
Can you use it in a sentence?
Hop in one fleek, you lit.
And it's going to be lit.
Major key.
It's time for the Urban Dictionary Word or Phrase of the Week.
So this week's Urban Dictionary Word of the Week is deptpression, D-E-P-T-pression. I know many of us are going through depression at this time, or just maybe came out of a depression. So the definition goes as this: when you're so broke, you spiral into a deep depression, stopping you from doing things that you love and hanging out with people. Example: hey man, wanna go out tonight? Reply: nah man, I don't want to get worse depression. This depression thing is actually a real thing, guys. Like, honestly speaking, it's a real thing. It's like, it's different from regular depression. Like, right, there's like this overall umbrella of like, yeah, I feel depressed, I feel whatever. But this is like a specific subcategory that many of us are experiencing right now, especially those of us who are professionals, because I think it's even more tragic, even more daunting as a professional person who on paper is supposed to be making a lot of money. You know, according to the world and Instagram, you are living your best life because you are in a career, you are doing this. But when in reality, like, a lot of us are going through the depression, we have a lot of debt, especially professionals, because we have professional degrees that came at a high cost. I mean, I would probably give a couple of toes, I don't know, a kidney, to get rid of some of this debt that I acquired through law school and my master's degree. Like, it's really ridiculous. And interest rates are going through the, I mean, why does it look like I'm owing more money? Like, I feel like I'm making all these payments all these years. I'm supposed to be decreasing in debt. And in fact, I'm increasing in debt because of these damn interest rates. It's out of control. So, you know, the one thing I will say is I feel like a lot of us are trying to really figure out, like, get out of this debt depression. Like, we're depressed because we are in debt. We have credit card bills up the wazoo. The student loan bills are increasing for whatever reason. We have no idea why, because we've been paying for the last 15 years. It's out of control. We want to travel. We want to spend time with our family. We want to do amazing things and actually live our best lives. But our debt is putting us in a space where we don't want to socialize because we're trying to save coins. We're doing all sorts of crazy stuff, working 2-3 jobs to make extra money to get out of debt. I mean, it's crazy. So that is the Urban Dictionary word of the week. I think it's really fitting, especially we're in summer. A lot of people are starting to, you know, try to take back their mindset, mindfulness, spirit when it comes to the debt practice. And so people are engaging in so many different ways to pay down debt. You know, people are joining these, you know, groups. They're signing on to these podcasts, these listservs to get tips about reducing debt. So I feel like a lot of us, although we are currently in a depression, we are trying to, you know, make ways to get out of it. So I would say that one of the biggest things you can do, or the most important thing you could do, is make a plan. So the budget, yes. And some of us are not that great at budgeting. We're just going to be honest with ourselves, but making the plan. Like, I have a goal that by December of this year that I will be paying off all my credit card debts. I tried to figure out, you know, not a generous way, but a realistic way to actually pay it down. Meaning, I'm not on this strict, I'm only, you know, eating peanut butter jelly sandwiches for 3 weeks. I'm not taking any Ubers. I'm not doing anything extreme. I think I have it's a very liberal way to pay off my debt that still will allow me to enjoy my life, because I still have one life to live, but to also make, you know, reach my goal of paying off my debt by the end of, you know, the month. So having a plan and then figuring out what order are you paying your debt in? You know, a lot of these things really matter. Like, which bill do you pay first? Maybe if you make an extra payment on this, like a lot of these little tips and tricks or whatever actually do work. So, if I were you, you know, again, there's a lot of podcasts out there. There's a lot of listservs, a lot of, you know, blogs out there. Credit Karma, download it. It gives you a lot of good tips sometimes of how to tackle your debt. Mint is an app that kind of gets your life together in terms of budget, and it forces you to see where you're spending your money. So for me, Uber and food is like my biggest, it's like my Achilles heel. Like, it's my biggest issue. And so when you get that notification saying that you spent X amount of money on Uber for the month, like, it makes you put things in perspective. So that is my, you know, issue, I guess, or my not issue, my advice around the Urban Dictionary word of the week. So I gave you a word and I'm giving you advice on top of that. So that's that. So now it's time for one of my favorite portions or segments of this show. It is now time for our big up of the week.
Watch it. And you feel big up, big up. All of the woman them big up, big up. All of the girl them big up, big up. All of the woman them big up, big up.
So this week's big up of the week goes to the California legislature. I feel like these last couple of big ups have been going to, like, you know, government. So I don't know if any of you guys are aware, but California has become the first state to ban discrimination based on one's natural hair. And so I know, like, maybe what, a couple of months ago, I had talked about New York City or New York State, you know, having a crackdown on the, you know, having like a ban on the discrimination of people with natural hairs. And it fell under, I think, the Human Rights Commission. They came out with this, but it looks like California has actually become the first state to outlaw the racial discrimination based on hairstyle. And so according to the Los Angeles Times, Governor Gavin Newsom on Wednesday signed a bill into law that legally protects people in workplaces and K through 12 public schools from discrimination based on their natural hair. The new law, which takes effect January 1st, prohibits the enforcement of grooming policies that disproportionately affect people of color, particularly Black people. This includes bans on certain hairstyles, such as afros, braids, twists, cornrows, and dreadlocks, or locks for short hair. And so Newsom continues and states, let's see, he goes on to just talk a little bit more about, you know, the workplace and school. You know, these are settings that we're in, right, for the majority of our time. And it's really important that, you know, within the workplace and the schools, that people, you know, are, I guess, afforded the opportunity to really, you know, to be their own selves, really, right? And I don't know if you guys remember the New Jersey high school student who was forced to cut his hair, his dreadlocks, or forfeit the match. And so a lot of these, you know, these incidents is kind of what, I guess, inspired this direction for California. And the article, you know, also stated that the indignity forced the student to choose whether to lose an athletic competition or lose his identity. And California is saying, we're not down with that. We're not, like, you shouldn't have to do that. Your natural hair is part of who you are. It's part of your identity. It's part of you. And for you to have to give that up in order to either compete in a competition or to be able to work at a particular job or keep your job is insane. So I definitely commend California for taking this stand and outlawing this form of discrimination. And I really hope that, you know, it definitely inspires other jurisdictions to follow suit, because this natural hair fight is a real fight. It's not a fake fight. It's a real fight. And in a lot of spaces, especially the more posh, the more conservative, the more corporate spaces, you know, women of color, men of color are having hard times being themselves in the workplace and are forced to either wear weaves, wear wigs, or to, you know, keep their hair low or to not grow locks or whatever it is in order to conform and in order to feel safe in a sense and not be targeted in workspaces. And we spend about 8 to 12 to 15, 16, whatever. We spend a whole bunch of time at work. And to be in a space where you cannot be comfortable within your own skin is, it's crazy to me. And I'm glad that there is a movement now to, you know, to allow people to really accept who they are and to be who they are in these settings. So big up to you, the California State Legislature, the Assembly and Senate, for unanimously passing this law, which is called the Crown Act, for those of you who want to look into this more. So With every high, you know there's a low. And this week, to be very honest, there are a lot of lows. And I would love to get into all these lows, but, you know, time does not permit me to get into all of this. But there are a lot of lows this week. And the one that I find to be particularly interesting is this backlash against Disney or whoever is coming out with The Little Mermaid. Like, this is, it's a part, like, I thought this was a joke, to be honest, when I was hearing all about these not my Ariel hashtags and this whole discussion about white people being mad. I was seeing a bunch of memes during the week about white people being mad that Ariel, that Chloe, is it Chloe? I think Chloe from Chloe and Haley, the singer, is, you know, was casted and will be the new Ariel in The Little Mermaid. She's going to be, you know, the little. I'm not at a loss, because, you know what? Again, this is the society we live in. But I was like, The Little Mermaid. There is really backlash against The Little Mermaid. And so I was trolling through Twitter and social media just to find some material for this, because I was like, this is really, it's really crazy to me that white people are really hashtagging not my Ariel and are really, you know, boycotting and calling for I guess Chloe to step down from being Ariel in The Little Mermaid. So there was one meme that I saw that stated, the fact that not my Ariel and, well, hashtag not my Ariel and hashtag colored were trending on July 4th should tell you everything you need to know. The people tweeting not my Ariel were raised by people who said not my drinking fountain and not my school and not my neighborhood, and were the same people screaming not my president when Obama was in office. Like, white people are really having a meltdown that there is a black girl playing The Little Mermaid. And I think it's absolutely ridiculous. And it just goes to show and to reaffirm that the racist rhetoric is still alive and well. And that we are, when people are boycotting because a little black girl or a black woman is playing a fictional, mind you, fictional cartoon animated character for Disney, they're boycotting this because she's not being portrayed as a white woman. I think that says a lot for our country. And I think it just goes to show how disturbing, you know, I keep saying Chloe. It's Haley. It's Haley. So it's two sisters, Chloe and Haley. Haley is the one that's playing the part. But either way, it's very disturbing that this is really, like, people are not dying in these streets. Cops are not shooting innocent black people, like, as we're talking right now. Like, there are not children who are hungry. Has the water in Flint, Michigan been fixed yet? Like, there are so many issues plaguing the American community. I'm not even talking about the global community. The American community, our society, our states. And this is what people want to be mad at? So there was, oh my gosh, there was another meme that I had seen about this as well. And this one was posted by DJ Majestic_1 on Instagram. And his post was saying, just so we're clear, there are racists right now trying to use science to prove that mermaids, non-existent mythological characters, are white. Meanwhile, though, in the 1992 cartoon, Gabriella was a black, I don't know if she was Latina, but she was definitely a mermaid of color. Brown skin, dark hair, mermaid of color. Like, it's one of these things where I'm like, and our kids are here watching this, right? Our little black girls are watching this fiasco play out in all of social media and all the internet portals, in the streets. And it's so disheartening that they're witnessing this. But then again, it's like, I don't know. I guess every generation has their blow up, right? This generation, their issue is, I guess their point of racism is mythological, fictional characters from Disney. Like, it's so for me, this is a big womp womp of the week. We have grown ass people really tweeting, saying that they are upset at Disney for casting a black Little Mermaid. Like, I feel like we need to do so much better. We have to do so much better. But in you know, I guess on a positive note, congratulations to, you know, Haley for being casted as the new Little Mermaid. I'm sure she's going to be fabulous. I look forward to going out and supporting this movie even more so. I mean, I always loved Little Mermaid. I always did. But even more so because of all of this. Because this is real BS. Real BS. And it just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I always say it doesn't make sense to me. It makes sense because I understand the society we live in. But it's so sad that, like, you know, the whites that are actually out here boycotting and protesting this, they're attempting to take, or they're not attempting, they are taking away the shine and this moment from Haley, because she should be celebrating this epic win for little black and brown girls all over the world. And instead, you know, we're here dealing with these hashtags, not my Ariel. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So womp womp to those people out here who feel like this is the good use of their time, and to continue to, you know, perpetuate this racist rhetoric and to push forward this anti-black, anti, you know, brown people agenda. So womp womp to you. All right, everyone, I'm here with my very special guest, a former professor of mine from Fordham University School of Law, Professor Tanya Hernandez. Hello, Professor.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. So, you know, I've been seeing you on Instagram and on LinkedIn, and I was like, what is my professor up to these days? And I see that you came out with this book, and you've been on this book tour going all over the world. And so I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great to have Professor Hernandez on the show? So welcome again. And I guess there's many people out there who might not know who you are. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and then we can go from there.
Well, I am a law professor, and I have been in law teaching for about 22 years, and I've been for Fordham now about a decade or so. And my primary area of interest is in issues of social justice, race, and gender discrimination. I look at those questions not only within the United States, but I like to think about these things comparatively. And so I look at, you know, how does employment discrimination operate in other jurisdictions? How are Afro descendants treated, you know, throughout the African diaspora? And these matters influence both sort of the conversations that I have with my students in the classroom with regards to civil rights law and what I do research and writing on.
Okay. And I remember when I was here at Fordham, I took your employment discrimination course and I took your wills, trust, and estates course. And that's how I fell in love with wills, trust, and estates, although I did not get into that field. But it was such an enjoyable class. And I remember when I was signing up for just the class in general, people were like, oh my gosh, this class is supposed to be so boring. It's wills, it's trust, it's estates. Like, who wants to deal with that? I'm like, oh my gosh. And it wasn't mandatory for us at the time, but I knew that it was going to be on the bar. And at the time, I was thinking about elder law. So I was like, I want to take this course. And it was probably one of my most favorite courses here at Fordham, because you're just such a vibrant teacher there.
Well, people say to me, how do you explain the interest in wills and also the interest in social justice? I said, you know, for me, they're both fundamentally about people. Mm-hmm. Right? And having personal relationships matter, and having people be treated with dignity and with equity. And those themes, you know, flow throughout anti-discrimination law and in trust and wills.
Yes.
And sometimes it's like, you know, it's easier to deal with issues of dead people than it is to deal with the race, and it gives me a little bit of a break.
But the one thing I will say, the scandals in the textbook, I learned so much about celebrities. And there's scandals. I was like, this is like, it was like a telenovela almost in the book.
Family drama is family drama. Yes. It only becomes that much more salacious when there's money involved.
Exactly. So you have went on to write this book called The Multiracials and Civil Rights.
That's correct.
And I wanted to definitely get into that and to talk a lot about it, because I feel like we are in this era where people are embracing their multicultural backgrounds. You have a lot of individuals who are, especially from the Latinas, Latinos, who are now saying, I'm not just Latina, Latino, I'm Afro-Latina. And this has become, I mean, for me at least, I've noticed it more within the last couple of years. You have all these celebrities now coming out and kind of like, you know, making a movement out of it. And so this idea of like the multicultural race is really like, you know, embedded now, I would say, within our the mainstream culture. And so when I saw the title of the book, I'm like, this is quite interesting, because there's always mixed reviews when people talk about, you know, what exactly is a multicultural? What does that even mean? And when we're talking about rights and discrimination, like, how does that play? You know, like, what does that look like? So I definitely wanted to kind of talk about the book. And I guess, what made you write this book?
Well, you know, the book Multiracials and Civil Rights came out of a confusion I was having. And the confusion arose when I started to read some articles, some news stories from various authors, where they would say, oh, you know, there's a growing population of people in our society who are neither solely one race nor another. They're the children of an interracial parentage. And so they have they have no single race identity. They identify in a much more fluid manner. Mm-hmm. And I was aware of this growing population as well. But here where I was confused was where the presumption was that being mixed race meant that anti-discrimination law wasn't good enough for multiracials, for people who are mixed race or biracial identified, because their fluid identity meant that judges wouldn't understand them or how discrimination was occurring. And moreover, that our civil rights laws that were created during a time of a very sort of binary black versus white historical framework, that those laws now really were too antiquated to deal with this more fluid racial identity. And I say the reason why that confused me, it's not a confusing argument, but what I found confusing about it is that as someone who came out of both, I don't identify myself as multiracial, but within the parameters of how they identify it or define it, you know, one parent is of one race, one parent is of another, that was definitely me. Not only multiracial, but also multicultural, because my family's from Cuba, from Puerto Rico, and I'm born in the United States. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's this multiplicity of cultural influences in the household as well. And yet, even with both that multiracial and that multicultural background, I never had experiences of discrimination that stemmed from being multiracial or multicultural. Mm-hmm. That is to say, when I experienced racial discrimination, it was always because someone found it problematic that I wasn't white. It didn't matter what fraction of non-white they thought I was, or what variation, or what language background. It was about being non-white as being problematic. Mm-hmm. And so I found that account that I described to you about how multiraciality is something so new that civil rights law can't handle it as confusing, because it just didn't square both with my personal experience and also with what I know to be anti-discrimination law and how capacious, sort of how flexible it is for dealing with anti-discrimination. Mm-hmm. And so that put me onto a journey of sort of wanting to track down the source of these stories for why there were some people who view anti-discrimination law as too old-fashioned to deal with a new world of mixed race identity.
Okay. Yeah, because when I was going through, you know, the excerpts that you had sent me, I was like, this is quite interesting. I can see how, you know, some people would actually even be offended to see that, you know, we have a group of individuals who are identifying themselves as multiracial, multicultural, who are almost calling for like a different standard, I guess, of law to be applied to them because they have, you know, different background. And when I was explaining to you offline that, you know, one of the things that popped into my head is, you know, that the, again, that whole one drop system when it comes to, you know, if you have any drop of African ancestry, you know, how society views you as being Black. And so therefore the discrimination you're going to get is, I won't say it will be exactly the same as somebody who's, you know, much darker, but, you know, you're a person of color, you're going to experience some form of discrimination.
Well, you know, the way I characterize it in the book is that when racial discrimination happens, it's a very crude experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is nothing nuanced or sophisticated about it. I mean, that's why it's discriminatory. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's about reducing someone's humanity down to an attribute. Right. And so, you know, it's not sophisticated. And in many ways, the, you know, what's jarring about it is just how oversimplified another person or institution is trying to reduce you down to. Right? Mm-hmm. And so some might say, well, that's just about the one drop rule happening. But, you know, there are many, but there are instances in the book where there are individuals who are multiracial who are not of African ancestry whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I've got a Filipina, a mixed race woman, a Japanese American mixed race woman, a story in the book, and some Latinos who don't identify as having any Blackness in them. Mm-hmm. I don't know how accurate that is, but in any case, that's what they say. And yet their stories of discrimination are all about how they were treated differently and unfairly based not on merit, but based solely on the fact that they were non-white. Mm-hmm. In ways that were problematic, right? And so that reduction down to your non-whiteness is more how we characterize what's going on, mm-hmm. as opposed to sort of squarely fitting it within just the notion about one dropness.
Yeah.
Although certainly it has echoes of that.
Well, I definitely think it's good that, you know, you brought in the examples of Filipinas and, you know, Japanese, because again, I feel like whenever we're really talking about discrimination, everybody, you know, they stop and they're like, oh, we must be talking about a Black person or Latino person. They don't really, for some reason, I don't see too many, I guess, examples or stories about a Japanese woman who might be half white, half Japanese, experiencing discrimination or what that even looks like even. So I think it is important that you discuss that there are these different individuals, these different backgrounds of people that actually experience discrimination. And at the end of the day, it's the reduction of who they are. It's not necessarily anything more than that. It's the way that they're treated because they happen to be of mixed race and they're, you know, women of color or men of color. Mm-hmm. So I know we had, before we had talked, we were talking about Afro-Latina and how that's, you know, become a thing now. I mean, at least for me, I think it's because the media is, you know, pushing it more so. And so now people are more aware of this movement. And so you identify yourself as Afro-Latina. And so I wanted to just ask, you know, at what did you always identify as Afro-Latina? And if so, you know, or if not, rather, I guess, when did you come to the realization or when did you decide to accept that?
Well, for me, there was never a single moment where, like, sort of like, you know, I discovered mm-hmm. I'm Black. And then instead, I was raised culturally with, the, you know, the embrace of our African heritage.
Okay.
I think, though, it's because it also came from a source of pain for my mother. That is to mm-hmm. say, when my mother was born, she was the darker member of the family. It's mm-hmm. a very Caribbean typical story.
Yes.
All right, some of us are darker, some of us are white, and we all know who's who.
Yeah.
Right? And so she was made to understand who she was and how undesirable her Blackness was from her skin color, from her hair texture. These were all problematic issues that the family had to suffer under.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? And because of that very sort of painful experience that she had, I was fortunate in the sense that she came to terms with the ways in which, rather than internalizing that negativity, she somehow was an incredible woman, had the strength of character to sort of like reject that. She also, you know, became an adult in the 60s at a time in which, you know, there's a black rights movement going on. And so, with that sense of the African diaspora, I think she had a way to sort of nurture and bring love back to herself that she didn't find within the family household. So given her background, you know, she was one of these parents in the 60s and the early 70s who was, you know, coloring the Hallmark cards for each birthday to make sure a brown face was looking back at me, and to nurture my love of blackness and my own self-identity as Afro-Latina. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting to me is that that's not a very typical story.
Yeah.
Within the Spanish-speaking Caribbean, the larger Caribbean, and throughout the African diaspora, there's much more of a sort of anti-black sentiment, you know, that creeps in within families in a very disturbing and detrimental way, right, you know, to people's psyches. But the Afro-Latino identity movement that you're referring to, that you're seeing in the United States, actually starts, sort of, as I see it, within Latin America.
Okay.
Latin America has had its own sort of coming to terms with civil rights movement and a growing embrace of blackness and black identity. And with that conversation going on in Latin America and with people, of course, you know, traveling back and forth, there's more of that embrace within the United States as well.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I was, you know, I have several friends, you know, some are Puerto Rican, some are Dominican, and it's always, you know, been that, you know, for a time, at least when they were younger, they did not identify as Afro-Latina. They did not want to, you know, accept themselves as black. In fact, some of them were, you know, my complexion, and, you know, I'm a dark-skinned woman. And even with them being dark-skinned, it was almost taboo for them to even acknowledge that they were black. And so now I feel like, I guess, because of you know, what you're speaking of, the Latin communities that I guess are embracing it a little more, is they're more comfortable now saying that they're Afro-Latina. So we're seeing a lot more of that. We're hearing a lot more of that phrase. But I did want to, I guess, get your opinion on it. We had spoken about this as well, too, that there are individuals out there, African-Americans, who find that it's problematic for individuals to add labels to themselves. So this Afro-Latina thing, it's like, well, why can't you just be black? You know, you look black. So why are you calling yourself Afro-Latina? Or is it something, are you trying to be special? Like, what is your opinion on that?
Well, you know, I think that part of what we see, you know, when we hear these kinds of perspectives is the result of the deficit in our race education in the United States, right? Or I should say really globally.
Yeah.
It's not just the United States. So that is to say, each of us grows up in our own communities with the idea of like blackness is only here, right? You know, it's a United States story. The slaves only came here. They were nowhere else. And what that does is it misinforms us and cuts us off from an understanding of the ways in which blackness, right, is much bigger, right, than just a U.S. story. Mm-hmm. And then in point of fact, only about, I think it's documented, like 3% of the slave trade was brought to the United States. If only 3% is in the United States, where's everybody else? The vast majority, Latin America and the Caribbean, right? There are many accounts that say that outside of Nigeria, Brazil is the location with the highest number of people of African descent.
Yeah.
Right? So the resistance to sort of Afro-Latina-ness as an identity, I think is in part of the dearth of our own race education, where we think, well, you know, oh, well, if you're not embracing African-American identity, you must be in denial because there's not a misunderstanding that blackness is bigger than the United States.
Yeah.
And that blackness also has its ethnicity to it, right? There's a political blackness, which we all, you know, share.
Yeah.
But there's also a cultural aspect to blackness that varies from geographical location to geographical location, even within the United States. So meaning to be black in New Orleans is one thing. To be black in Alaska is another,
yeah.
Right? And it doesn't make anything more or less black than the other. There's this comedian who just had an HBO special, Amanda Seals.
Yes, Amanda.
We love Amanda.
I'm Insecure. And one of my favorite lines, of the many favorite lines I have from her HBO special, I Be Knowing, is where she says, every black experience is a black experience unless it is anti-black, quote, end quote. I loved it so much and I like memorized it. I mean, and what I took from that is for her sort of acknowledging, and she is very proud to say how she has a master's in Afro studies from Columbia University, is that blackness as a cultural phenomena varies greatly, mm-hmm. right? We sound different across different places. We eat different foods. But if you eat jollof rice or you eat rice and peas, it doesn't make you any less black, right? As a cultural matter. But politically, that's where we all have something to embrace. But saying Afro-Latina doesn't diminish your political blackness.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to kind of go back to the book a little bit with respect to, you know, there were parts in the book that talked about, again, multiracials feeling like they're facing discrimination that I guess is different from that of, you know, I guess black people or this monoracial, I think, mm-hmm. is what was characterized. So what types of discriminations, like, would, I guess, somebody who's multicultural feel is like, how does that differ from, you know, what the mainstream thinks discrimination to be?
That's right. Well, here I want to make sure I have clarity. Right? Mm-hmm. So there's one, so the story about the story of discrimination, mm-hmm. that is to say that commentators, what they are sort of interpreting and distilling from
yeah.
sort of experience, hearing about people who are multiracial going to court and filing mm-hmm. discrimination claims. And then there's the actual stories mm-hmm. of people, you know, and going to court and what happens to them. So I've already described to you sort of what the story is
yeah.
about their claims, all right? Oh, law's not good enough. Law needs to be revamped. We need something special
mm-hmm.
For multiracial identified people. The multiracial identified people, though, it's different. That is to say, they do come to court and say, and that's what unifies all the cases in the book. Right? They do come to court and say, I am mixed race. That's my racial identity, right? And mm-hmm. that is different, you know, from, you know, prior generations. You know, June 12th is the anniversary of the Loving v. Virginia decision,
mm-hmm.
right? So that 52 years ago, on June 12th, the Supreme Court finally says bans against interracial marriage. That is no longer constitutional,
mm-hmm.
right? And with that, then, legality to marrying whomever you want across race lines comes the birth of more mixed race children
yeah.
and mixed race families who are multiracial identified. So this is new. But when they then proceed from this is my racial identity and then move on to and this is what happens to me, their description of this is what happened to me is the same
yeah.
as any other story of racial discrimination. That is to say, I applied for a job. I applied for a rental apartment. I tried to access this public accommodation, a restaurant, a hotel, etc. Right? So meaning I tried to access the public good and I was denied that public good, not based on merit, but based solely because of race. Not because of how you identify, but because of race.
Mm-hmm.
That is a unifying factor across all the stories that is no distinctive from an anti-discrimination story back of 1942 as it is from a story now of 2019.
Now, do you think that there will ever be any, I don't want to say merit to these claims, but do you think that there will ever be any further investigation with respect to whether or not there actually is some sort of difference? Because it seems like there, you know, these commentators feel like there is a difference. So there needs to be laws. There needs to be reformation. And we're saying, no, it all looks the same. But do you think that, especially with the growing, I guess, number of mixed race you know, people. Because I think, I don't remember what the year, there's some prediction that by the year, I don't know, let's just say 2050 or whatever, America will be a mixed race nation and that's that. Do you think that there will be any type of pressure or any political pressure or anything to, I guess, find some sort of merit to this particular claim?
Well, I think there's two things going on. One, we would have to say that anti-discrimination law wasn't, didn't have enough capacity, right, to deal with the multiracial identified claim would mean that we'd have to see a whole change in what's going on. Meaning a change where people are being excluded from a public good because of their mixedness, as opposed to the particulars of their racial background.
Right? Okay.
That is, as of yet, it's not appearing in the cases, right? I'm not saying it might not, but this is not what we're saying.
As of now,
right?
Yeah.
The other thing, though, is that part of what is also being identified as discrimination that is particular to multiracial identified people isn't really discrimination. So let me be specific. Part of what the commentators, not the people who are suffering exclusion and go to court, mm-hmm. but the people who talk about them.
Right? Yeah.
So part of what the commentators say is problematic is that the judges often will reduce a claimant's racial identity down to a single race that they view as the pertinent race. Mm-hmm. So for instance, someone will come in, they'll say, that, hello, judge, I'm mixed race. My mother was white. My father's black. I went to apply for an apartment and they told me, they called me the N-word and told me I couldn't access this apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the judge says, and this is clearly against the law, you know, as a black person, right? The commentators view that move that the judge makes, meaning I will concede a lack of courtesy in describing the claimant in the same language that the claimant uses to describe themselves. So meaning a judge oversimplifies someone's personal racial identity mm-hmm. down to a single race. I agree. As a matter of courtesy, it would be preferable for a judge to reflect back exactly what you say to them as to how you view yourself. Right? But that itself, that move the judge makes, is not discrimination. Right? The judge isn't excluding you from a public good. The judge doesn't have some important event turn on misdescribing you, if you will.
Yeah. Right?
In fact, the move that the judge makes is every single time a reflection of the very story that the claimant has told. What do I mean by that? I mean this. That after the claimant says, I'm mixed race, they say, and what had happened was, right, when they say, you know, what, yeah. what happened to them. They then describe the way in which they were reduced down to non-whiteness or lumped together with lots of other people of a single race, typically black, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
And that the judge, in doing the analysis, is responding to the significance of the non-whiteness that the claimant herself or himself has raised.
Yeah.
Meaning the judge is actually being quite responsive, right? Even if for the commentators who talk about it, they view that misdescription as discrimination. For them, in other words, any resistance to you being able to say, I'm mixed and I'm proud, right? That itself is a form of discrimination that anti-discrimination law should speak to. It is, in other words, a reduction of anti-discrimination law down to an individualistic, dignity-based kind of view of anti-discrimination as opposed to a social group sort of material inequality approach to understanding what is significant about discrimination.
And I think that it's interesting to like also just to talk a little bit more about, you know, what exactly, you know, what is like the prime definition of discrimination? Because in the line of work that I do, there's a lot of, you know, we get a lot of claims of discrimination. And a lot of times when you really investigate, you're like, oh, you mean you were harassed. This is harassment. Or, you know, it's something else, but there's no treatment really. Like, they weren't demoted because of their race, or they weren't terminated because of their race, or they weren't denied something because of their race, but they might not like the way that they were spoken to, or they don't like the way that things are going. And so sometimes I feel like, for lack of a better word, discrimination tends to be what, you know, people, you know, they name it, they call it discrimination. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, maybe there needs to be more of an understanding as to what discrimination is in general.
Well, I mean, we have two things that are problematic, right? One, we have few worker rights in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's problematic for everybody. Right?
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of this language that you hear from people, like, you know, this bad thing happened to me, typically in the workplace, because that's where you spend most of your time,
mm-hmm.
right? And indeed, most of the highest numbers of claims come out of the workplace context.
Yeah.
Right? Typically, because in other places, like, you know, a restaurant excluded you, well, you go someplace else to eat. A landlord wouldn't give you access to an apartment, well, you go find some other place to live.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that should be the way, but
that's
people
how you
often
do it.
Use what you call the power of exit. Whereas in the workplace, it's hard to find another job. So you fight tooth and nail for that job. Okay. So we have few worker rights. So people try to express and create some form of good treatment for themselves with whatever legal tools they have. And we have very few.
Yeah.
So they'll turn to anti-discrimination law. The other sort of dynamic that's going on with what you're describing in your work is that discrimination law does encompass harassment, but only severe and pervasive forms of harassment.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you describe, if you haven't been, let's bring it back to the workplace, denied a promotion, paid unequally, fired unmeritoriously, meaning if some significant work access hasn't been impaired, if it's just bad treatment, then the courts, our legal doctrine, will only treat the bad treatment from a legal matter as discrimination if the harassment was so, and here I'm quoting, severe and pervasive that it altered the conditions of your work, right? So that is to say, not just a one-off comment, right? I mean, the one-off comment may be hurtful.
Yeah.
It may stay with you. And I'm not saying that's right. But for now, our legal doctrine doesn't allow for the one-off comment to be addressed. It says, no, this has got to be enduring, pervasive, severe, such that it makes the workplace an impossible place for you to
mm-hmm.
be, right? And that's not right. That's bad for all of us, though. Again, that's not particular to multiracial identified individuals. That's, you know, impoverish legal rights for workers, impoverish understandings of harassment in the workplace. That's bad for all of us.
Yeah. So in the book, the book talks about the woman by the name of Jill and how she was in the workplace, and she identifies, I guess, as mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
She's biracial. One of her parents are white. The other one is black. And how her boss, I guess, wrongfully presumed that she was a white Hispanic because, I guess, of her light skin. But it turns out that she actually is black and white. And apparently, because of his discovery, she was treated poorly in the workplace. And so I wanted to kind of talk about these particular instances, you know, and how they occur in the workplace. And, you know, how this starts off, what recourse does an individual have if they are in the workplace and they receive this type of discrimination?
Well, the story of the young woman that you described was sort of a very successful one, because she had, and many of the multiracial identified claimants have this so-called, if you want to call it, a benefit, right? The benefit of the before and the after, right? Meaning,
mm-hmm.
if they are, as they say, racially ambiguous looking enough.
Yes.
Right?
Meaning, that's the term now.
Right, that's the term. Like, you know, and though, interestingly enough, the term racially ambiguous isn't just about multiracial people. Like, meaning, you know.
Yeah.
You could have just one racial grouping of parents, but you just happen to look light.
Yeah.
And so And because of that, people view you as being racially ambiguous because they're like, who are you? What are you? Mm-hmm. Right? The typical question to people who don't box very easily. when the multiracial person sort of does happen to look racially ambiguous, because they don't always. You know, sometimes you could be mixed and be dark skinned, yep, natural hair, and there's nothing ambiguous about it, right? But if you do look as what others understand to be racially ambiguous, there's the before, when they thought you were mixed, but they didn't quite know what, and it was okay. It was sort mm-hmm. of exotic and interesting or whatever, right? Then the after, when they figure it out. And so in this young woman, what happened to her was that, you know, she, after a year working there with no problem, getting good performance evaluations and what have you, some of the darker skinned family members show up to work, picking her up lunch, you know, giving her a ride home after work, what have you. And that's how the supervisor finds out that, oh, it's not just mixed. Part of the mix includes African American, mm-hmm. and for this particular supervisor, that was problematic, and that's where she was treated badly. Because she had that before and after sort of built into her story, mm-hmm. it was very easy for the judge to say that, oh, the merits of her claim, you know, are quite strong. And so, you know, she has a very good resolution. She actually reaches an out-of-court settlement, and that's typically the win mm-hmm. in the anti-discrimination law, and is, you know, paid a fee and walks away into the world with her out-of-court settlement payment.
There was another story about a sergeant.
Yes.
And that one I thought was pretty interesting. I guess he also passed as white. I think he was mostly white, but he had like maybe a 19% or 18% Native American, something like that. And he was the sergeant. He was, I guess, being promoted in the ranks. Everybody loved him. It was great. And then he took an Ancestry.com test or whatever that revealed that he was, I think, 19% Native American. And I guess he was just so happy to...
Well, actually, it's a little different. It's a little close. It's a little different. So he is someone who's white appearing, mm-hmm. right, and understands himself to be white because his whole family always look white and they always describe themselves as white. And he's from the Midwest in Michigan. Like, there was no confusion. I wish we were on screen. Like, show you an internet link of his face. You would not. He is not racially ambiguous. In other words, you will look at me and say, "Oh, he's a white man." Okay. So everything about him is white. He has this family folklore.
Okay.
About some distant relative who was Native American.
That's what it was. Yes.
And so he's curious about it. So he does an Ancestry.com test after 10 years of working on the police force as a sergeant, and discovers that no, there's no Native American. But there is about 18% sub-Saharan African.
That's what it was. Yes.
So he goes to the workplace. And, you know, these are his coworkers and people he's been working with for, like, the last 10 years. And describes to them, you know, oh, hey, isn't this kind of amusing? I thought it was going to be one thing. It turned out to be another. And then they start to harass him, calling him Kunta Kinte.
Yeah, they called him Kunta.
The slave name from the Roots book and movie series. And they start to exclude him from important work training mm-hmm. opportunities. And eventually, you know, this racialized treatment of him continues until he is terminated.
Yeah.
And so for him, this was not based on merit. It was based on now this new understanding of him as being non-white. Mm-hmm. I mean, he still looked the same, right? And so what I find very helpful about that story of his is that it helps sort of underscore the ways in which this is not just about a dynamic that's going on in the world about how you look.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It is about what we understand race to be, as socially constructed, as invented as it is. It still has a power, and it's a power of exclusion. Yeah. And that's why we have to deal with it on its own terms as an issue of race and racism, and not just about how someone looks.
Yeah, and I think that that's very important to think, because a lot of people, again, you know, when we're thinking about race, it is about how somebody looks. But I think this particular story, although I hadn't seen it, but I imagine that, okay. I mean, because I see people in the street all the time that I'm like, oh, this person's white. Mm-hmm. But they actually might have something else that causes them not to fully be white. But how these individuals were working with him for so many years. I'm sure they went to each other's homes, because you know how the police force is. Mm-hmm. They're very chummy. And then one Ancestry.com revelation changes the entire, like, spectrum. And it's like the perception of him now I guess it's whatever they perceive people of color to be. I don't know, criminal, thieves, whatever negative stuff that comes to mind. And it is very powerful. And I think that a lot of people do experience that in the workplace. But I think that employers have such subtle ways now. It's like almost in some cases that it's like, well, we can't be so overt about it anymore because we're going to get lawsuits and we can't afford to be sued. So they find such subtle ways to either reprimand so that I guess at the end of the day, if you were to come and bring a suit, it's like, well, no, there's this pattern of poor work performance, or you've been on your cell phone three times, and they try to find merit in the ways to get rid of people. Is there any way to, I mean, I know it's I guess it's weird of me to even ask, but is there any way to kind of like be on guard or to kind of protect yourself from these subtle attacks that are now taking place in the workplace?
Well, you know, it is true that we do not have the worker protections that would be most desirable. Right? And with the decline of the unionized workplace, you know, it's become worse and worse over time. The one thing that we do have, how effective it is, you know, work with what you have, right? And what do we have now in this more non-unionized world? We have the rise of social media.
Right? Yeah.
And so the extent to which something very foul happens in the workplace, even if you don't have worker protections, you know, that some are able to sort of deploy the workings of social media to an extent to try to give transparency and have a policing of employers in that manner. But, you know, obviously there's built-in limits to this. You know, how many employers are so public-facing that they care? You know?
Yeah.
How many employers are such that the social media would even care to pick it up? Like, you know, what happens at Apple, I'm sure we're all curious about.
Yeah.
what happens on the bodega on the corner of Flatbush, maybe not as much.
Yeah.
Right? But yet a worker could be just as vulnerable and being done wrong. And that's unfortunately, you know, part of the problem that we are sort of living in. And I guess in some way, sort of circle back to some of the raison d'être of the book, is that we already have such fragile civil rights laws, you know, meaning there's so little that we have for workers, for people wanting to make sure they can have access to fair housing, right? You know, the whole gamut, that we do not need anyone saying it should be tinkered with.
Yeah.
We're hanging on this stuff with a reed, you know? And so we need to fortify it. We don't need to have it be diminished in any way whatsoever.
Yeah. Fragmented and all of that. Because I think that's exactly like what I guess the commentators are in a sense doing. Because now people are just confused. Because I'm reading this, I'm like, are there protections? Or like how? Because that's what was going through my mind the entire time. Like, what is different about the discrimination? Like, what is it? Is there something that I'm missing? Maybe there's something I'm missing. But from my understanding of the way discrimination works, I was just like, what other protections? Like, what? It just didn't make sense to me. And I think that confusion is definitely not necessary for the reasons that you just gave. You know, it is a very fragile system. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with these rules and laws as time goes on with this administration. So I think it's definitely, it's very interesting, I guess, these arguments. Now, I guess what is your hope for this book? Like, what do you hope, I guess, that this book, I don't know, does for, I don't know, for education, for society? Like, do you have any specific goals?
Well, I guess what I wanted to do was first to provide clarity about the way in which a fluid racial identity can coexist with an understanding of the importance of political race. Right? Mm-hmm. That is to say, your understanding of who you are and what's important to your identity not only can be very nuanced, it can also change over time. It can change from one location to another. And that's all equally valid, right? But at the same time, that doesn't mean that the fluidity of identity takes away from an understanding about how social group status or a perception of your membership in a social group is any less important. I mean, you can have a growth of a more sophisticated or multifaceted way of personally identifying and still be very realistic about the simplistic and crude nature of how discrimination is manifested.
Okay. So what's next after this book? Are we writing more books?
The new book. I'm in the middle of it now.
Okay. Any exclusive that we want to drop here?
I can drop a little hint. The new book, sort of, in some respects, you might almost, you know, as movies are in a trilogy, this is almost like a trilogy. So book one was racial subordination in Latin America, right? So that was all looking at the perversity of how racism operates within Latin America and the anti-Black bias sort of that is cultivated in the Caribbean and in the Spanish-speaking African diaspora and in Portuguese-speaking, right? The second book was Multiracial and Civil Rights, looking at how some of these very same tropes of racial mixture as something distinctive, which you see in Latin America as a defense to, oh, we don't have racism, we're too racially mixed.
Right? Yes.
Playing itself out in the United States. The third book sort of melds the books one and two together to look at how Latinos in the United States manifest anti-Black bias vis-a-vis Afro-Latinos and vis-a-vis African-Americans throughout anti-discrimination law. And sort of, and how do we need to come to terms with that, with this growing demographic within the United States? So how law should be responding and or not responding.
All right. And when can we look forward to this book?
About another year or two out.
Okay, yeah, okay, okay. I mean, this one, we're celebrating this one right now. I'm going too fast. So where can we find the book?
The book is available online at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble. Also, if anyone wants to get a 20% discount, they can purchase it directly from the NYU Press website and use code PC20.
Okay.
And then knock 20% right off.
We all like discounts here. We love discounts. Now, in terms of social media, if somebody wants to reach out to you, like how would one reach out to you?
I would love for them to direct message me on Twitter. I can be found at Professor TKH. And follow me. Add to my two followers.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your book and just talk about discrimination in general. And I think it was, I mean, I enjoyed the conversation and I think that people will definitely find it very interesting. And your personality is always so vibrant.
Oh, it was a pleasure to have this chat with you anytime.
You were listening to According to RP on